Well, good morning. Like Pastor Matt said, we'll be going through 3 John today. It's an incredibly short book. It's only about 15 verses. It's the shortest epistle in the Bible, but you can read it in about 5 minutes if you're going slow. We're going to take the time and go through it now, and then we'll get started. So John writes, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. For I was very glad when brethren came and testified to your truth, that is, how you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than this, than to hear of my children walking in the truth. Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers. And they have testified to your love before the church. You would do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support such men, so that we may be fellow workers with the truth. Now, I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us and with wicked words. And not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. The one who does good is of God. The one who does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself, and we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. I had many things to write to you, but I'm not willing to write them with pen and ink. But I hope to see you shortly, and I will speak face to face. Peace be to you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends by name." And so I said again that 3 John is a short book, but there's an incredible amount of information packed in the text here. Within it, we find the foundation for supporting gospel workers, but we also have a series of character profiles in the text. We have Gaius, who John says nothing but positive remarks about, and then we have Diotrephes, who is the polar opposite of Gaius. And then we have Demetrius. He's another brother in the faith that John gives his approval of. But what I want you to pay particular attention to is a command John gives to Gaius in this text. If you look down in verse 11, you see John writes, "Do not imitate what is evil, but what is good." This is the focus of the entire passage. In fact, if you have your pen and you're taking notes, underline this phrase, because this is what John drives to the entire time, and he uses these character references to make that point. But what I want us to do as the church today, as Missio Dei Fellowship, is very much the same thing John urges Gaius to do. Imitate what is good. This goodness is not appealing to some vague generality of goodness, nor is the evil that he tells Gaius to flee from vague. It all centralizes upon the idea of hospitality. What he calls good, then, is the support of those who go out for the sake of the name. Now, for us, that hits really close to home. We have the new church plant, and because of this, of course, I walked away from the text with no other conclusion that it is an incredibly timely passage for us to look at. The reason being is that we have, if you will, in this specific time, a case study. We can look at this text and examine ourselves with it. We are a missional church. That's why we planted. That's why Pastor Matt is going through a core study on the idea of missions and who we are as a church. So when we look at this passage today, I ask that we would look at it with a keen eye towards who we are as Missio Dei Fellowship and where you fit in respect to that. Now let's look at verse 1 and get started. The apostle writes, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth." Now this verse is fairly straightforward. I'm not going to spend a ton of time here, but what I want to draw your attention to is the idea of John's love for Gaius. It's not a general love, but it's a very specific one he has for him on the basis of the truth, meaning this love stems from the fullness of the faith. It's a positional love. It's bound up in the fact that they share this common bond of biblical truth that defines a relationship and binds them together as brothers in Christ. Now think of it like this. It's kind of like that affection you develop when you get to talking with a stranger. And one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden you both find out that the other person's a Christian. But what's more than this, they're a faithful Christian. They love biblical truth, and they actually obey the scriptures. They practice what they believe. This is what John has in mind with Gaius here. Obviously, he knows him, but he has a love for him on the basis of the truth of the Christian faith. In verses 2 through 4, then, we see John write, "Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. Why? For I was very glad when brethren came and testified to your truth, that is, how you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than this, than to hear of my children walking in the truth." Now, people have taken verse 2 in so many different ways simply because of how John frames what he's praying for. Some latch on to the notion of prosperity and good health, while others diminish the fact that he is praying for Gaius' success and health. At the end of the day, though, what it's really getting to the heart of is simply John is praying for Gaius to have all things go well for him in every respect. He notes that his soul is already prospering, so John is conveying a general sense of hope that in all things, both body and soul, he prospers. The idea is expressed simply that whatever Gaius puts his hands to, John prays that the Lord would bless. But I want you to notice the reason why. John isn't focusing on Gaius's business venture here. He speaks with reference to his faithfulness to the truth and his love for the brethren. Now pay attention to the fact that Gaius has been validated by the brethren. They came and testified of his truth, meaning very simply how he walks in respect to the Christian faith. Now for the apostle, that term walk in truth simply refers to the one who abides in faithfulness to the gospel's calling, meaning they're obedient to that truth. And so Gaius is not a character that John needs to rebuke for anything here. He's, in fact, the contrary. His character is vouched for by others, and John simply recognizes this here and gives praise where it is due. Gaius is of notable character. He's consistent in his theology and practice. He not only sees the Christian call to love the brethren, but he actually does so in such a fashion that others will specifically go out of their way to report these things to the apostle. And so we can say he's living a life defined by sound doctrine and practice. What's of special significance here, though, is that John states he has no greater joy than to hear that his children are walking in the truth. We have a wonderful metaphor right in the text that likens this to a father's affection for his own children. Now, I can tell you with my kids, when I look to them, there's not much else that brings me greater joy than when I hear a good report when I get home from work. If I get a negative report, though, that sets the tone for what comes next. They know that if I hear of disobedience, they receive discipline. They certainly don't get my praise. The idea here in this text is simply that John, again, is well pleased with Gaius' conduct, and he offers his praise to him. His obedience doesn't change John's love for him. However, it certainly brings him joy. John, the elder, speaks to his child in the faith, and he's well pleased with the report he's heard. Now, think of this with respect to your own elders here. There is nothing that will give them greater joy than to hear and see that you are faithful to the gospel's calling upon your life. Now think of how glad they would be to have a stranger completely out of the blue come to them and report and how great your love was towards them and your service towards them in Christ. But this joy they would also have is the mark of a faithful shepherd. They're not in it for sordid gain in any respect. They're not out to make a name for themselves or build the brand, if you will. Their greatest concern is your maturity in the faith. They have a genuine interest in your well-being, and they directly correlate your well-being with your walk. But just look at how John speaks of Gaius here. He isn't touting his authority or credentials as an apostle, even though he easily could. He speaks to him as if he is his own son. And so you can't help but picture John with a fondness in his heart when you read this. Now, continuing in verse 5, he writes, "Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers, and they have testified to your love before the church." Now, think about that again. Everything he is doing, again, for the brethren, Gaius is doing faithfully. Faithfully. There's no selfish ambition. There's no conceit, hypocrisy, or malice in regard to any way in which he serves. And this is precisely what John has in mind as he's praying towards Gaius' success and good health, is that he may continue in this good work. Notice John, though, says that this is especially true of him when it comes to supporting people he's never even met before. His impact is so great that they testify of his love in the presence of the entire church. What this means is that Gaius' love is a love that pours forth blessings upon those who are in the household of the faith. He took care of them. He took them into his home. He gave them food and lodging and whatever else they needed. And what's more than this, he didn't do this for his best friend in the faith. He did it for strangers. But Gaius did even more than this. He would have served as the one who guaranteed these men to the Christian community. And so hospitality was not simply a means of welcoming people into your home. It served to vouch for and establish the character of those strangers before the entire Christian community. When I preached on 2 John, if you remember, I gave a basic outline on the function of hospitality in this time period. It served an incredibly important purpose. It maintained not only the safety and well-being of those who were strangers, but those inside the confines of the church. If you had a good reputation when you brought in a stranger, simply by showing them hospitality, you were vouching for them. And so in this context, each person at the church was the watchman at the door. Here too, you are responsible for guarding your brothers and sisters from those who wish to do them harm. But on the flip side of that, basic Christian love and faithfulness dictates that you would show genuine care for your brother and sister. This means you must have some discernment. For one, you have to be able to separate those who John would call antichrist from those who are genuine believers, and then you deal with them appropriately. You utterly shun the false teacher, but you open up your arms as wide as possible for the orthodox teacher. And that's what's going on in our text here. Gaius has not only gone into his pockets to ensure they are met with all that they need, but he has, by virtue of his hospitality, verified they are genuine, sound teachers. They are not the same men John would indict in 2 John as children of Satan. No, they are those who teach according to sound doctrine, and Gaius vouches for their character and orthodoxy. And so then we see him go on to say, in verses 6 and 7, John writes that Gaius would do well to send these men on their way in a manner worthy of God, for they went out for the sake of the name, receiving nothing from the Gentiles. Now, based on everything we've heard thus far about Gaius, I don't think it would be responsible to say that the apostle is rebuking him here. Rather, I think he is exhorting him to continue in this good work. And he gives them a simple reason why. He says they went out for the sake of the name. They received nothing from the Gentiles. Well, let's dig into this just a little bit. John writes, Gaius would do well to send these people on their way in a manner worthy of God. That little phrase, send them on their way, just means that he was to assist them in their journey. So what he means for that is for Gaius to continue to provide for them even after they leave. John commends Gaius in the beginning for his faithful hospitality, and then he encourages to send them in the same manner. Folks, if you've ever wondered where people got the idea of supporting strangers who go on the opposite end of the globe to preach the gospel, or as we like to call them today, missionaries, this is your text. But notice here that John brings this down even a little bit further by asking Gaius to send them on their way. How? In a manner worthy of God. Well, what does he mean by that? That phrase, worthy of God, is used several times in Scripture. Most often it refers to how you and I must live in a manner worthy of our calling by which we have been called. And so here it is also actually used in that same sense. So we could say that it is simply with reference to God or showing relation to God. Very simply, John is saying that Gaius ought to provide for them in whatever means that they need because they are genuine workers for the gospel, and they are God's children called for this purpose. Why? Well, look at verse 7. For they went out for the sake of the name, meaning Jesus, receiving nothing from the Gentiles. First thing to observe here is simply that they are those who have gone out for the sake of preaching the gospel. That is their specific calling. That is what they've been gifted by God to do. Gaius not only took the time to take them in and support them, but he vouched for their character and orthodoxy. Now, they may or may not be able to earn a meager living while doing this, but regardless, John says support them in a manner worthy of God. He's arguing that simply by virtue of their calling and their faithfulness to that calling, they are to earn the support of a man like Gaius. But look at why, though, right here in the text. They are receiving nothing from the Gentiles. Notice it's the present tense. It's ongoing. There's no reference to a point where they will receive anything from the Gentiles. And frankly, why would they? Do we earnestly believe that a world who thinks the gospel is complete foolishness will support those they see as running a fool's errand? Now think about that in relation to you here. We take part in multiple things each year to support those who have gone out for the sake of the name. We send our pastor, or we're going to send our pastor, Lord willing, to the opposite end of the globe so he can instruct other pastors there in sound doctrine, so that these men can then go back to their own churches and put that into practice and teach others sound doctrine. And then they too can send out workers for the sake of Christ's name. There's virtually an unending supply of gospel work that we can support. But let me ask you, if you aren't giving to these things, who else is going to do that work? Will the Gentiles? Is your unbelieving coworker or neighbor going to send Pastor Matt on his way to Ethiopia in a way that honors God? Are they going to give to Voice of the Martyrs or something similar so that people who are being persecuted for simply believing the gospel are being killed, that they could have things as basic as towels and soap, shoes, and if they can get them to them, Bibles? No. We would be utterly foolish to think that unbelievers would even remotely care about these people. Now, some in a vague sense might feel philanthropic and give them their basic needs, but our context in this passage goes so far beyond this. It's with reference to the gospel and their status as messengers of that gospel. Throw that in the midst and look at how quickly an unbelieving world will turn away from that charity. So John writes in verse 8, "Therefore, we ought to support such men. We ought to support such men in order that we may be fellow workers with the truth." And so because an unbelieving world won't bother to pour resources into men who preach the gospel faithfully, people like us ought to support them. But notice why. It's not shame. In order that we may be fellow workers with the truth, or probably better translated, in the truth. This is right at the heart of why we give to those who have gone out for the sake of the gospel. We share in their labor. That's all he means by this, but it's extraordinary, and we should be excited about it every time we hear it. When he uses the phrase, "in order that we may be," the verb he's using actually gives more of the idea of being made into that thing. It's a passive work. It's as a result of supporting those men. For those of you who have taken Greek, it's in the subjunctive mood. It's the mood that shows something that might come to pass. It's contingent. But here, it's contingent upon supporting these men. And so what John is saying to Gaius is that through supporting those who go out for the sake of the name, he is made into a co-laborer in the truth. He's actually participating in that work as if he's there. And so to you, by you guys giving to these things, God has made you co-laborers in a work that actually might bring people to grips with their sin before a holy God. That small task of writing a check that you and I don't always think about actually is part of the work that God has ordained for us to participate in the Great Commission. John Piper has put it so wonderfully in saying that there are three types of people. There are the goers, there are senders, and the disobedient. That's it. You and I don't fall into another category. And so when we look at this, we can actually say with confidence that in a very real sense, our money can go to something far greater than a 401k. It can go to something far greater than a night out. Not that these things are bad, But our money can go to something far more splendid and of greater eternal significance for the person who is literally dangling over the pit of hell. Why? Because it can support the one who has gone out for the sake of the name. So they can reach these people. So they can bring them hope. That support isn't meant to build up a church so it sits fat and happy in the pews. It isn't meant to support someone so they can just sit around and do nothing. It has a very specific purpose, and it is for anything that enables those workers to go out and faithfully proclaim the good news to the lost. And so we send them on their way in a manner worthy of God, because thereby we literally take part in the work of the Great Commission. What wonderful news is that? In verses 9 and 10, John continues, and here's where it gets really interesting, because we're introduced to Diotrephes. Now look at what John writes in verse 9. I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words, and not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so, and puts them out of the church. Now talk about a stark contrast. You have Gaius, who has a solid report from everyone. His love is so significant that strangers in the faith go out of their way to tell the apostle how much he cared for them. And then there's Diotrephes. He loves to be first among them. Diotrephes is the guy whose sole focus is himself. He considers himself to be wiser than the ones whom Christ was pleased to build the foundation of the church upon, meaning the apostles, so much so that he rejects a previous writing of the Apostle John out of hand. John, the apostle, the one whom Jesus loved, is not accepted by Diotrephes. Now, what John wrote to the church is most likely the same thing he's been telling Gaius here. Support these men who have gone out for the sake of the name. But Diotrephes, who just happens to know better than John, does not accept the authority of the apostle. Now think about that in light of the practice of hospitality. Diotrephes, by virtue of his rejection of the apostle John, is telling the entire community he is not to be trusted. But it goes deeper than that. Diotrephes somehow managed to get himself into a position of authority in the church. The text really doesn't specify if he was placed there or if he simply climbed into leadership and made his way up the ranks. But regardless of that, we get a clear indication of how he led. Diotrephes not only rejected the apostles, but he committed slander against them. The words used here to describe his wicked words would be better translated as wicked nonsense, meaning that what comes out of his mouth is not only completely unfounded and evil, but it literally makes no sense. It is the incessant babbling of a fool filled with divisive rhetoric for the sole purpose of discrediting them and slandering them. It is the unintelligible, unfounded, utterly wicked speech of a fool. But he's not content to stop here. Diotrephes just can't pass up the opportunity to be filled with more malice and pour this out on the men who have gone out to do gospel work. He refuses to welcome them. Remember, this had a much more severe implication in this time period. They wouldn't have another place to go. They wouldn't have another meal to eat, a place to sleep, and their reputation for being an orthodox gospel preacher meant everything to the community of the faith. But Diotrephes simply won't have it. He won't give them food or lodging. He will not vouch for their character so others might give them the provisions they need so that they can just survive and continue to do gospel work. Diotrephes loves to be first among the brethren. And for this reason, he rejects them. Now, that's something that John indicts as a characteristic of the one whose father is Satan. But again, he doesn't stop here. Now, Diotrephes actually prevents those who wants to support missionaries, and he casts them out of the church if they're found disobedient to those desires. Think about that. He actually prevents them from being able to serve and love the brethren, and he simply solves it by excommunicating them. He casts out brothers and sisters who are desiring to participate as co-laborers for the sake of the gospel, and he treats them as if they are unbelievers. Now pay attention to what John is saying here. He specifically indicates that Diotrephes is so successful in this that he's excommunicating those who have the simple intent to do it. They haven't even done it yet. They've just made those plans. But imagine what he would do to a guy like Gaius. He's not only able to get around a guy like Diotrephes, but he does so in such a fashion that other people sing his praises loud and clear. Diotrephes loves to be first. He wants all the praise. Do you think he would take kindly to that kind of affection for a man like Gaius? Not in this lifetime. Notice how far his ambition to be seen as the top guy in the church drove him. He steamrolled his way to the top, and even here he was not content. Now, do you guys remember the game King of the Hill, right? Now, guys, when you played it, it could get pretty violent. You did pretty much anything and everything you could to stay at the top of that hill. You had the high ground, so it was a bit easier to defend. Somebody would climb on up, you could just shove them down. And to add insult to injury, you'd call them names, maybe throw a dirt clod or two at them. That's Diotrephes, except he's doing it in the church. I think of a guy like Mark Driscoll, who somehow managed to get himself into a position of authority at Mars Hill. And then he steamrolled anyone who questioned his leadership. If you read any of the stories that came out at this time, story after story just simply showed his complete brutality. He slandered, bullied, threatened, and legitimately devastated people's livelihoods. And I'm not just talking about leading them into spiritual ruin. He actually accomplished their downfall from positions of authority. He caused them to lose their homes and jobs. And anybody who was willing to listen to those he cast out and to help them got the same exact treatment. Then when it all came out, he just simply picked up shop, played the victim card, and then moved on to a different denomination where he can lead without consequence today. He's probably preaching today. That's a Diotrephes. But notice the big difference here between that story and the story we have here in 3 John. If John arrived, he's going to call out Diotrephes in front of the whole church for his evil deeds and malice. One of the sad things about the whole fiasco with Driscoll is that you didn't see any of the big-name evangelical leaders call him out for his evil deeds. It's not the pattern from the text here. Here's the mark of a true apostle. John says he will rebuke this man in the presence of the whole church. He's going to follow a legitimate course of church discipline. All the while, we've seen Diotrephes do the exact opposite of this. All the while, he fancies himself to be the best of the best. But John's coming. John is not pleased with Diotrephes, and he's going to put an end to it. But right here, in light of all of this, I'm going to turn to you and issue the same command that John gave to Gaius. John writes in verse 11, "Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. The one who does good is of God. The one who does evil has not seen God." Now, this is where John has been driving this letter the entire time. He's been setting up these two characters with an eye towards this command, "Do not imitate evil, but good." Now, it has a specific reference. John isn't appealing to a vague notion of good and evil, but specifically, he is pitting Gaius and Diotrephes against one another. Gaius has been doing good. Diotrephes has done nothing but evil, and there's no end to it in sight until the apostle comes. So you have literally two opposite ends of the spectrum here, and John looks at Diotrephes and says to Gaius, "Be nothing like him. Don't emulate this man. Don't follow in his footsteps in any sense." John didn't care if Diotrephes was a gifted speaker or teacher. He didn't care if he was administratively gifted. The way this phrase is set up is to pit these two themes at such disparate ends of the spectrum that there's simply no confusion over the matter. There's nothing worthy to emulate. The well is poisoned. Now John says to Gaius here, like you would your own child when they're taking stock in the words of a fool, don't listen to him. Don't let him take control and influence you so you stop supporting those who go out for the sake of the name. Keep supporting them. Keep being faithful. Keep doing good. Nobody else in the world is going to support my beloved children. Why, though? It's right here in the text. Because the one doing good is from God, literally meaning they are genuine children of God. They belong to God. But the one doing evil has not even seen God. Remember the words of Christ in Matthew 13. He said of the religious leaders, though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. Now, Diotrephes is this man. Think about it. Here's a guy in the day when those who literally witnessed the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ are available to him, but he simply rejects them. And more than this, he is set to slander their character. He hates the brethren, and his actions show that he does not truly know God. For though he claims to walk in light, he is still in darkness. And again, this is where I turn back to you and reiterate the words of the apostle. Beloved, do not imitate evil, but good. Now, some of you have people in your life that you look up to that you simply ought to flee from. Their lives are not marked out by faithfulness to the gospel or a love of the brethren. Instead, they seek to bite and devour anybody in their path. They have their eyes set on being king of the hill. Others still are not even motivated by the gospel, meaning they preach Christ in vain. And while we may rejoice that Christ is yet preached, I ask, is this the person you want to be like? Do you even know what characteristics are worthy of imitating when it comes to godly character? For your parents, this is where it gets hard. Can it be said of you that your children see you as a person worthy to imitate because you are so fixated on faithfulness to the gospel's calling? For those in leadership, in any sphere of leadership, or aspiring to leadership, do you think you can do it better and know better than those God has entrusted your soul to? I'm not saying elders are infallible, but what I'm asking is, what is the disposition of your heart towards them? Do you trust them? Do you believe they are godly men who seek your benefit continually? Or do you complain behind closed doors about how things could be done so much better if only they took it your way? Have you considered that maybe the suggestion you've offered is not good for the whole of God's people here? Now, in your sphere of leadership, again, we all have some capacity that we lead in. Are you exercising that authority in a godly way? Or are you steamrolling people to get your way? Are you stepping on the toes of those who are seeking to serve the brethren in a genuine manner simply because you aren't willing to concede what little ground you've been given to begin with? Beloved, do not imitate evil, but good. Now, for you young people, for you teenagers especially, this is very, very important. Take notice of who you look up to. Are they really worthy of your attention? The incredible athlete whose life is in shambles, who's thrown away his entire family, or is in constant trouble with the law. Is that who you look up to? Or perhaps the prankster who stumbles upon a dead body in the woods and makes a mockery of their corpse. He's the guy you want to be like? Or perhaps that young woman who does nothing but objectify herself. And she gets caught up in every single affair of this world. And she spews forth nothing but gossip. Is that who you want to model your life after? If you want to know what a life of foolishness looks like, my wife and I can sit down with you. We can go over our own life prior to knowing Christ. We don't keep that a secret from people, mainly because we hope people see it for what it was. abject folly and rebellion. It was filled with nothing but pain. It was filled with nothing but stupidity and hatred for God. If you want to know where following a fool leads you in your early 20s, we can give you the perfect bad example. Choose your role models incredibly wisely. Those memories can't be unmade. Those actions can't be undone. That knowledge will continue to wreak havoc as you battle the flesh, and it'll be all the more difficult for you. There simply are things out there that are not worth knowing and doing. Here's where you stop, though, and take a look around you and ask, who here in this congregation is worthy of being imitated? Who here is somebody you can pattern your life after because you know they are faithful and well spoken of by the entire church? Now, if you haven't found yourself someone you can look up to in this way, find them. They're here. And then listen to them and start to put what they tell you into practice. If they are worthy of imitating, they're not going to steer you in the wrong direction. Beloved, imitate what's good. In verse 12, then, John also vouches for another. He says, Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. And we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. Now, Demetrius is likely the one who's bringing the letter to Gaius, but he also might be one of these gentlemen who's going out for the sake of the name. What is almost implied here in the text is that John, by vouching for Demetrius, seeks for Gaius to put into practice what he is already doing. In other words, Gaius is going to be given another chance to practice hospitality yet again. Notice again that Demetrius has a good testimony from everyone, and even the truth itself testifies of him. It's an interesting little phrase, but what he likely means by that is that the truth, the nature of it itself, verifies men. So when we stand in opposition to truth, the truth itself stands in opposition to us. It stands as a witness against our character. In other words, the truth is a standard by which you and I are measured against and aligned to. And the apostle writes that he and the apostles also bear witness to the character of Demetrius. And Gaius is, again, more than aware of their valid testimony. Now think about this, again, with respect to everything I've said thus far in regard to hospitality. Hospitality is the vehicle through which Demetrius will be taken care of and sent on his way in a manner that meets his needs. But ask the question, why? Because he's a faithful brother in Christ. It's really that simple. That's it. Now, finally, John closes this letter. He says, I had many things to write to you, but I am not willing to write them to you with pen and ink. But I hope to see you shortly, and we will speak face to face. Peace be to you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends by name. In the final words of the epistle, John simply closes in saying that he will say the remainder of what he wants to say until he sees them face to face. We don't know what this is, but I'm not going to spend time speculating on that. A couple of quick points, though, before I sum everything up. For one, John gives a traditional blessing at the end of his letter. Just like he has made sure to say he prays for Gaius' well-being, he does the same here at the end. It's similar to the idea of shalom and has a specific reference to God, and especially with reference to salvation in Christ. In closing, he passes greeting from the friends and extends his own greeting to the friends at Gaius' church. It's an incredibly personal letter, but it's also very pastoral. What I don't want you to lose sight of, though, in the content of this section right here, is that these letters, the content of it was knowledge to those in those circles. The church John is at, as he writes it, they're aware of the situation with Diotrephes, and they care about it, like any faithful or brother or sister would. Now be sure to note that just as Gaius's reputation exceeded him, so too did the reputation of Diotrephes. He accomplished his desire to be the preeminent one among the brethren. Probably not in the way he had first hoped, though. But the entire history of the church, the legacy of Diotrephes lives on. But it is one of brutal malice. Now, we've seen a lot in this passage that can be tempting to go down into the rabbit trails with. But I want to draw everyone back to John's command. Do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Now again, the focus of this is born out of these character references we've been given. We see that Gaius is faithful in all he does in support of men who have gone out to preach the gospel. We see toward the end that another man by the name of Demetrius is also faithful. And he's also vouched for by the apostles and the truth itself. And then we have Diotrephes, who occupies our focus as well. Now, he's arrogant, he's brash, he's domineering, spiteful, and filled with all malice. His actions actually prove to deter the work of the gospel, and he gives us no indication that he's actually believing that gospel. He might give an appearance of godliness, but the fruit of his life is filled with the deeds of the flesh, and he is in abject rebellion to God as he rejects the brethren. At the heart of this, though, I believe there's a warning for all of us here to heed. Gaius was not above receiving this direct command from John, and so I don't believe any of us are exempt from it either. The fact of the matter is that any one of us here can fall prey to our own desires, even if we start with good intent and honorable goals. I look at the example of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They believed they loved God, right? But what did they truly love but having preeminence? Jesus identified them as whitewashed tombs and open graves. While looking pristine on the outside, they were dead on the inside. They loved to be noticed by men and do their good deeds in front of them. They made a spectacle of themselves by broadening their phylacteries and lengthening their tassels. They made a show of their religiosity. They loved to be called rabbi and take the high seat at the banquets. They loved to be first among the people of God, all the while imposing a burden that they would not be willing to lift even a finger for themselves. But what did Christ do but pronounce a series of woes upon them? It's fair for us to take this as a warning and to ask in our sphere of influence, are we a Diotrephes or a Gaius? And perhaps you're neither. But then ask yourself, what trajectory am I on? Am I the person who loves to be first? Or am I the person who loves to make Christ first? Do I imitate evil or good? Now here, again, this stands out in the context of hospitality. It all centralizes upon the idea of supporting those who have gone out for the sake of the name. For the sake of the name. I've used that phrase all throughout this sermon here, and it's incredibly important. It's for the sake of the name. It's all about Christ. He is the preeminent one, not you, not me, him. Listen to Colossians 1, 15 through 20 as I read it real quick. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, meaning preeminent, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in him everything, in everything he might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have the fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Christ is the preeminent one. Christ is the great one. He is the only great one. He will always be the glorious Messiah who's not only created everything in existence for his own possession and pleasure, but through his death and resurrection, he has reconciled all these things to himself. When a mere man stands in the gap to take preeminence, what else is he doing but seeking to supplant the one who is truly first among the brethren? This is what it all boils down to here. When you find a man seeking to be first, guess who he puts in second place? At the root of this, we find Diotrephes so preoccupied with attaining notoriety that he does everything he can to stop the work of Christ. And so I appeal to you, as your brother, once again, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Find someone you can imitate that's worthy of your imitation. And then ask yourself as well, am I worthy of being imitated? If there was a church full of Tom Guthries, or Kendall Barriers, or Grayson Gilberts, would you consider it a healthy church? In other words, would you consider it a commendable one, one you'd recommend your friends and family go to? But not only that they act faithfully in whatever they put their hands to, and they graciously open their arms as wide as possible to receive and to send out those who have gone out for the sake of the name. And they do so in a manner worthy of God.